And you are listening to, what's it called?
Recovery Radio.
Oh, right. I almost forgot. Recovery Radio on KRFP. I'm Johnny. She's Denise. And in the studio with us today is Jonathan. He's a recovering alcoholic. And welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Why don't you start us off with a little bit about yourself, and we'll go from there.
Okay. Well, I was born at a very young age. I don't know. I grew up in a pretty conservative, I guess you'd say a religious family. My father was a minister and a missionary, and he unfortunately succumbed to a heart attack at the age of 43, and I was about 5 years old. So mom, at 38, got stuck with the chore of raising four kids as a widow. I grew up part of that time in California, Sacramento. Had a pretty decent childhood there. There was a lot of fun times to be had at the river that we lived by. Eventually, most of the family moved up to the Northwest. Some of my siblings, my older brother and sister, went to Seattle Pacific University up in Seattle. And my older sister ended up working for an outfit called Youth Outreach that ran group homes for behaviorally disturbed kids in Vancouver, Washington. And I eventually landed in Vancouver, Washington, and ended up starting myself to be work with troubled youth. Did that for a few years. Spent most of the last 40 years on the west side over in the Vancouver area and up in the northwest, like Squim. And I'm a recent transplant to the Palouse area. I've been here since April of 2014. So I like it over here. It's a little bit different than the west side, but the recovery community here is really tight-knit, and I really like that about this place. It's not too big, and it's not too small. There's plenty of meetings to go to. Like I said, it's a pretty tight-knit community, and I've made a lot of good relationships and friends here, and established a fairly decent program of recovery in this area because of that support. So here I am.
Excellent.
Fantastic. Before we do any questions, why don't you tell us about your story of recovery, Jonathan?
Well, I guess I started using things. I probably had my first drink at 13 or 14 years old, and I remember going out with a couple of buddies of mine and robbing one of their dad's liquor cabinets, and three of us drank about a fifth of vodka and a pint of rum mixed with a quart of orange juice in about 20 minutes. And for 13, 14-year-old kids, first time drinking, needless to say, we were not smelling very good that evening. lost most of it, but I guess I was drinking alcoholically right from the beginning. I didn't really drink a lot over the teenage years, but I did get into smoking a lot of pot and doing acid and stuff like that as a part of culture that I grew up in. So I guess my story starts more with being into that kind of stuff. By my 20s, my early and mid-20s, I was partying pretty heavy, and I was playing semi-pro sports with some pretty good volleyball players, beach players, and USVBA stuff. And we played hard and we partied hard. I don't know, it was probably in my mid-20s that I began to realize that I was working with kids, and I was trying to set a good example and teach them how to be, you know, productive members of society. And that created a bunch of dissonance inside of me. I didn't feel good about doing that kind of work and being the party animal that I was. By the time I hit 30, my family, my brothers and sisters, became pretty concerned enough to do an intervention on me. So I actually agreed to do that. They all got together at one point and sat around and had a chemical dependency counselor there, and they had their lists and stuff like that. And I didn't really have an emotional reaction to that. I didn't get angry like some people do, or break down and get all weepy about it. But what they didn't know was that about 2 days before they did that intervention, I had gone home one day and just laid down on my bed and wept for about 5 hours straight. And I didn't know why I was crying, and I didn't know why I felt so empty. I knew something was wrong. And that was actually, even though I didn't know what to call it at the time, my first experience of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that we talk about in recovery. The disease is really a hellish place. And I didn't know what was going on, but I knew that I was soul sick and something needed to be done. So they said, we're going to put you in the treatment center for a month. And I was like, okay, great. So I went in there, and it was the fourth floor at St. Joe's Hospital in Vancouver, which was called Turnaround. And it was a pretty good recovery-based chemical dependency treatment center. And I went in there, and after about 2 days, I realized they wanted me to say that I was an alcoholic.
Oh, dun, dun, dun.
And I was like, nope, that ain't happening. So I walked out of there and left and went home that night and promptly got drunk and put my car in a ditch and showed up at the treatment center the next day and said, well, maybe you guys are onto something here. I better try this out. So I actually learned a great deal about chemical dependency and the disease of alcoholism in that place for the first time, and felt pretty good about the recovery process that I was introduced to there. Got a little bit of an understanding about the disease of alcoholism and chemical dependency, and did some intensive outpatient treatment after I left there when I graduated, and did some for about a year. I think I stayed in there in their counseling sessions and classes, and stayed sober for 3 years and 4 months, decided I was well. So then I took off and went to South America, where nobody would know me, and tried drinking again. And lo and behold, the sky didn't fall, and the earth didn't rattle and shake, and I didn't immediately turn into Mr. Hyde. And so I thought, okay, this is good. And I actually did drink again, drink for 6 years after that, and eventually became pretty prolific in my drinking, I guess is the way to put it. And I got to a point eventually to where it was, my life had become pretty awful. I was losing jobs. I was doing a lot of dishonest behavior. I lost a relationship with a gal that was very important to me. And I could not understand why something that started out so sweet and fine and beautiful eventually and slowly turned into disinterest and disgust and self-loathing in spite of everything that I could do to try to save it. It ended, and that broke me enough to want to get into recovery again. And I actually started, I went to another treatment center and started working a real program, because I hadn't really had a whole lot to do with Alcoholics Anonymous before that, or meetings or any of that kind of stuff. I was familiar with it, didn't really want it the way a person that really wants recovery wants it. And found myself a good sponsor, found myself a good home group, got into doing service work, and I eventually began to work the steps and the 12 steps and understand them. And I had a really good sponsor who laid down some pretty specific expectations of me to do things like 90 meetings in 90 days and have a home group and call him every day and meet with him once a week and get service position. And basically, he was a great sponsor and introduced me into recovery, and I owe him a great gift to this day. And I stayed sober for 7 years. I'm 60 years old now. And as I said, my recovery process started when I was in my 30s. When I was 30, that first intervention took place. I have since been through 8 different treatment centers, which means that I'm very familiar with the concept of relapse. But I'm currently about 5 years sober, close to 5 years sober. But I've been through a lot, and I've come to an understanding of what it takes to recover from this disease that I hope will keep me sober for the remainder of my days. What's important to remember is that it's not my doing. And I think that a lot of people that get into recovery, that go through a treatment center and learn about recovery and chemical dependency, try to use that information to stay sober. And that's a legitimate effort. But it denies the entire concept of recovery, which is that I'm powerless over alcohol. And once I start thinking that I can do this thing on my own, that I'm smarter than it is, that's the beginning of the fall. I need help. I cannot do it on my own. It is a we program. Most importantly, I need a higher power that I am willing to trust to take care of me. And it's taken a long time to get there, but I've finally been able to grab hold of that and maintain a fairly long period of sobriety. And the way that I do that today is that I stay in the middle of the thing. I do about 6 meetings a week. I don't know how many meetings I actually need, but what I've come to discover is that I don't go to meetings because I have to. I go to meetings because I want to. I like being in the middle of the fellowship. I like the people that I meet there. I like the friends that I've made. You know, it's a program of honesty. And while alcoholics and addicts in their disease are the most vile and distrustful people in the world, people that are in recovery and serious about it are the most trusted people in the world, is what I've come to discover, because they are honest.
How long have we known each other?
I'll second that, what he just said.
I just haven't had an opportunity to disappoint you yet, but...
I agree with what he just said. I think that's great, Jonathan. I mean, we're not talking about perfect human beings, but that analogy is... I don't know, it's a pretty good assessment to me.
Well, I like it. I like the idea of, being able to... trust people, you know, based on watching their actions. I mean, that's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual program of action. So, when you see people behaving right, it makes them much easier to trust them, because not only being not trustworthy, you know, in my addiction, I was untrusting as well.
Well, and I think one of the biggest parts about being in recovery is we learn how to apologize and own when we've done something that's wrong. I mean,
that in itself
makes me feel safer around people in recovery, because I know that they're typically going to see it, you know, they're going to own it, they're going to apologize, and then they're going to talk to somebody about it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, there's that, you have this community of people who are there for you when you're ready to make a change. They support you and help you along your way. So... yeah, I just think that really helps with the honesty and being genuine.
Well, as a recovering alcoholic with, 30 years in and out of this program, I've got a fair idea of when I see somebody that's here that is actually working a program that's genuine and authentic. And what that means to me is that if they're staying sober and they have a little bit of time within there, I can trust them. The first paragraph in How It Works in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous uses one word three times, and that word is honesty. And that's a big clue about what's necessary in this in order to recover. You know, it doesn't matter if you're lying to me, but if you're lying to yourself, you stand very little chance of recovering from this disease.
Yeah, I believe in the AA preamble, it says, you know, it references rigorous honesty, and it even talks about someone who, you know, there are those who have grave mental and emotional disorders.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and read it, Johnny.
Sure.
This is the first paragraph of How It Works, Chapter 5 of the Big Book. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. So if I'm not lying to myself and my life is an open book and I'm not trying to hide anything from you, then I'm somebody you can trust. Mm-hmm. I'm not hiding anything. I'm not lying to you. And the people that are actually working a program of recovery are like that. And generally speaking, they're the most trustworthy people that I know. They're not using some sort of passive-aggressive manipulation technique to get me to do what they want. They're not, you know, telling me stuff they think I want to hear. Because to do those things, they wouldn't be able to stay in recovery. Their life depends on it, as does mine. Sometimes things get uncomfortable when we are honest about stuff. But that's just the way recovery works. And it's actually a much better way of life. If I'm able to clean out those dark spaces inside my own mind and my own heart that I'm ashamed of, and that's basically what this program is all about, is getting rid of that stuff that's controlling my behavior. I'm only going to be as sick as my secrets. So
that's right.
It's just a way of life that seems to be much easier. This is the easier, softer way. If I can go through life without having to hide things from people, it's just a better way of life. It's real, and it's okay. You know, sure, life is life, and there's going to be disappointments, and there's going to be hard times. But that's okay too. Today, because of this program of recovery, I've come to be able to appreciate the magic and the mystery of life for what it is, and be willing to experience that without having to alter my state of consciousness. I'm not afraid of it. You know, I feel better. I feel my pain better. I feel my joy better. I feel my happiness better. I feel
Absolutely.
Everything better, and I'm good with that. I don't have to get drunk to deal with it.
So. You can actually process.
Right. I've heard it said that the truth will set you free, but first it'll make you a little bit miserable.
Sure. And we don't have to do that truth by ourselves either.
That's right.
That's what makes it so amazing, is to have people walk alongside of you as you're dealing with something. And the fact that you don't have to hide that, it really, to be able to share things that, you know, that are hard for you, I mean, it just takes the power away from the thing that is troubling you, or the shame, or whatever it may be. And that is an amazing feeling.
Yeah, and the beauty
doesn't sound like it would be, but it's amazing.
No, it is. And I found that the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have never met anybody. Let's just say of the people I've met in AA, somebody has a part of my story. Somebody has done something evil that I have done also. So there's a resource there to help me resolve that, you know, to help me, clean house, and get rid of that and learn how to deal with it.
It's the most important thing a newcomer can realize when they hit their first meeting or when they start talking to other alcoholics is that they are not alone. Because I know when I got here, I knew I was different from everybody else, and I was sick. And some of these people had the ability to live life and cope with work and jobs and other people that I didn't have, and I didn't know why. You know, nobody handed me an instruction booklet on how to be a human being when I was 5 years old. I didn't get it, you know. And the truth is that just about every alcoholic that I talk to, their story starts out that same way. Somehow they felt like they didn't belong. Somehow they felt like they were outside. They didn't know how to feel the way other kids felt when they were growing up. They didn't feel like they belonged to the community. And then they found alcohol, and that fixed everything. That was the solution. Now I can be a part of this.
Absolutely. That's my story.
And that solution actually works for a while, until it doesn't anymore, because what the alcohol does is it destroys our reasoning. It poisons our body. It breaks our spirit. And most of all, it breaks my heart. And eventually, the process by which it does all that stuff brings me to a place of devastation and horror and abomination, that the realization that I cannot live this way any longer. I must stop this way of life, this drinking and this chemical that keeps going on, and then the realization that I can't, because I've tried and I can't stop, you know. So you come to that place where you understand that there's no way I can stop drinking, and I have to stop drinking. It's utter hell. And that's the place that we in recovery call pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And once you've hit that place, you're ready to do just about anything to find a solution. And I'm not saying that AA is the only solution, but it's the only thing that I've found that works, you know, I'm a fairly intelligent guy. I read, you know, the encyclopedia when I was 12 years old and have a pretty good IQ. And unfortunately, most of the people that I meet in recovery are well above average intelligence. And that doesn't do us any good in trying to recover from this disease. It's a stumbling block. I should be able to think my way out of this, and it doesn't work.
Yeah, my best thinking got me drunk.
Right.
Exactly.
You know, and it comes around to a real big part of recovery, and that's being willing to ask for help. The first step says, admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Well, if I'm powerless over something, if I don't know how to fix the heater coil in my truck or, you know, run this sailboat or whatever, I'm going to need your help. Please come help me to do this. And that's where it all starts. So the admission that I'm not all powerful and the admission that I do need help to do things in life is the great equalizer. It's the great getting me right-sized to go along in life. Because if without that, then I'm just isolating myself. I'm playing God again. And you know,
it just doesn't work.
It doesn't work. You know, and it goes back to the thing I was saying about, you know, being somehow separate from other people, you know. And it's, you know, people that are not alcoholics or addicts can't really understand the way we think. It's a special form of insanity. Why can't you just stop? I can. Why can't you just stop drinking?
Right. Heard that more times than I care to remember. But speaking of stop, what we're going to do right now is we're going to take a little break, listen to some music, and we'll be back on Recovery Radio. I'm Johnny, she's Denise, and we've been talking with Jonathan, and let's hear some tunes.
Beat up and battered around. Being saying that, but I've been shut down. You're the best thing that I've ever found. Handle me with care. Reputation's changeable. Situation's terrible. But baby, you're adorable. Handle me with care. I'm so tired of being lonely. I still have some love to give. Won't you show me that you really care?
Everybody's got somebody to lean on. Put your body next to mine and dream on.
I've been fucked up and I've been fooled. I've been robbed and ridiculed in daycare centers and night schools. Airports terrorized, sent to meetings hypnotized, overexposed, commercialized, and
we are back on Recovery Radio, and I'm Johnny, she's Denise, and our guest in the studio today is Jonathan.
And, so,
Denise, yeah. Let you take over for a minute here. I hope everyone has their pens and pencils ready.
So this is Denise, and I've got my usual numbers I'd like to hand out, but today I also want to add in Palouse River Counseling in Pullman, Washington. That number is 509-334-1133. Again, Palouse River Counseling in Pullman, Washington.
Jonathan, mm-hmm. Your experience with them was?
I had an outstanding, a really good recovery program going through them. They were very helpful in many ways. Their chemical dependency program is really awesome. They have several different outpatient programs going on there. The counselors, like I said, were really knowledgeable about chemical dependency and alcoholism and very helpful. And they also have other mental health programs there. I actually had a separate counselor there that was very helpful to me in dealing with my depression. Most addicts and alcoholics, eventually, if you're a chronic user of any drug or alcohol, you're going to fall into some form of clinical depression. And so anyway, they were very, very helpful with that as well.
And they also say on here, cost of service, fees are based upon household income with adjustable payments available for those who qualify. We accept most forms of health insurance, including Medicaid and Medicare. Inability to pay will not prevent you from receiving services. Also, there's a number for state funding that I want to give out. It's called BPA. And it's for the state of Idaho. And you can call them. And this is a really great way to just do this in private if you'd like to do it yourself. And find out if you qualify for some funding. Typically, intravenous users or pregnant women are usually funded right away. So that number is 208-336-4275. And again, you can just call and answer some questions, and they should be able to tell you if they can help you out with funding. But I mean, just as I just read, typically the treatment centers, they want to work with you, you know, even if you're in a really hard situation. And a lot of times, you know, you might be homeless, you may not have a job, and they're familiar with that, because a lot of times that's what happens in our addiction. So don't be afraid to just ask some questions and see what your options are, because typically there's more options than you would assume. This is an outreach program for the Lachal Recovery Center, which is located downtown in the Old Wheatberries, and their number is 208-883-1045, and they offer a variety of different kinds of help there. They have NA meetings, AA meetings, they have recovery counselor, peer recovery counseling. And they also just have a plethora of information on their wall for resources, for just everything you could possibly think of. Daryl and the rest of the staff there are extremely helpful, extremely friendly, non-judgmental. They've all been, you know, they've all been in recovery, so they've all been there previously as to that struggle.
Right.
Yeah. And then there's Celebrate Recovery that meets on Friday evenings at 7 o'clock at the Real Life Campus. And the number there is 208-882-2484. And I guess we'll go ahead. Oh, and Al-Anon meetings meet Monday at 7 p.m. at the Good Samaritan. And then Wednesday at 7 p.m. at the Pullman Presbyterian Second Floor Library. And then Friday at 8 p.m. at Gritman Medical Center. And there's also different NA meetings at the Gritman Center. Also,
right,
so
right.
I mean, you could always call Gritman and find out about their meetings, and they're usually held in that like side convention room.
Right, right. The entrance on 7th Street.
Yep.
The bottom floor. And as far as AA meetings, you can go online to AADistrict22.org, and there's a listing. They have a schedule there of all the meetings in the area.
Yep.
And there's a meeting every night of the week, and every weekday at noon at Lachal Recovery Center for the people who, they call it the Getting Lucky Nooner.
To go on your lunch break. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
That's great. It's awesome.
And, you know, if you need one, half a meeting is better than none.
Absolutely.
And quite a few, I attend that meeting off and on, and it's not unusual to see somebody come in with their bag full of hamburgers or a salad and catch a meeting and have lunch at the same time, and nobody gets too worked up about it. So,
yeah, nice big table. You can sprawl out your food. It's all good.
Yeah,
you could probably even ask for a soda or a water while you're there.
Right, exactly. Coffee is always on, by the way. That magical elixir of AA meetings that keeps them moving. The old story is, if you're trying to find an AA meeting, just drive around all the churches in town at about sundown, look for the people drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes by the basement door.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually a pretty good key.
It is.
And now, why don't we roll back to Jonathan. Tell us about your life afterwards, Jonathan.
Well, my life sober, you mean, I guess, because there have been periods of sobriety that were interspersed with periods of drinking, and I actually don't count those sober periods as wasted time. You know, I know there are people that get into recovery and get sober once and stay that way for 20 or 30 years or until they die, and I'm pretty impressed with that. I don't understand it myself. I had to pretty much get beaten up very bad by alcohol to finally get this thing. And like I said, it took me 8 treatment centers. Today, there's a little bit of a difference for me in that, you know, a lot of people get into AA and they have a problem when they bump into step 3, which is, you know, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. and this clamor against religion, and, you know, oh my God, I have to become a goody two shoes, and I have to, you know,
I'll never have fun again.
Right, you know, and it's just, I want to stress this, that AA is not a religious program. It is a spiritual program, and it is about being able to make that connection with a power greater than yourself, which is necessary. And step one, I'm powerless over alcohol, so I need help. And if that just means the AA community or the group that you're in, that's a good enough place to start. I can't stress enough how the insanity of this disease tells us that someday we'll be able to drink again, you know, and that's part of the disease itself. And it's the big lie, you know, and many of us pursue that illusion into the gates of insanity or death. And that is a true thing. Not too many of us actually get recovery. And that makes me pretty grateful today, not only to AA and the AA community, but also to my higher power. One of my favorite things in the big book is, and I just can't stress this enough, and I'm not going to get religious on you, but...
more than welcome to get religious if you want. You can share whatever you like.
More times than once, many times in this book, it'll give you one or another version of this, and it says the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. So I need some sort of power outside of myself, because I don't have the power to stop drinking, and no other human power has that. Finding out a way to grab onto that is sort of what this program is really all about. And making a connection with whatever that power is to you. It's really integral, and it doesn't mean you need to get religious. It doesn't mean you have to start going to church every Sunday.
Although you might.
Or you can.
Hey, me personally, I do go to church every Sunday. I know my Bible better than most pastors do. But that's me, and that's my relationship with my higher power. And I'm not about to tell anybody what theirs is. It's be like me trying to tell you what your relationship should be to your wife or your husband. I can't do that. That's your relationship. And what's important is to realize that, I wouldn't give the care of my will and my life over to another person that I didn't trust. So step three says, you know, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Why would I do that unless I thought that God had my best interest at heart? I would not. So it's important to come to realize what God's intention is for us as individuals. For me, Jonathan, what is his intention towards me? And come to find out that it's actually pretty good. The book tells us God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. Okay, good deal. Sign me up. I've been living in hell this long. I don't want that anymore. I want this happy, joyous, and free. So what do I do to get that? So we have this little process called the 12 steps. And nobody can really explain why it works. But in the process of working these steps, we eventually come to a place where something's different in us. And that's 12th step, we call it a spiritual awakening. Psychologists would call it a psychic change. The church would call it a renewing of the mind. But something has changed. And the process is a very fascinating process. It's well worth the time going through. I was talking earlier about, being alone and feeling different and apart from other people. And I see that in the stories of people in the big book, and I hear it in people's stories in meetings. And once again, if you're a newcomer to AA, the most important thing to realize is that, no, you're not alone. There are others, and there is a way, there's a solution, and it's an interesting thing. We call this disease alcoholism for lack of a better name. And I suppose that's because, trying to cure my problems by drinking is like trying to put out a fire by pouring gasoline on it. It's pretty much the same thing, You know, you're not going to make things any better. You're going to make things way worse.
Yeah, absolutely. It's when your mind gets hijacked by alcohol, and you're trying to fix your mind with your mind, what could possibly go wrong there? It's an impossible job. I remember when I came in to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had that great aversion to that very common religious experience as a child. And, you know, if God is, you know, all good and wants people to be happy, joyous, and free, why does he let, you know, babies die of leukemia? That was just where my head was at that time. And I had a sponsor who said to me, well, you know, if you're having trouble with this God thing, can you believe that I believe? And he was happy, joyous, and free. And I said, sure. Okay, I can believe that you believe. And he say, okay, that's a good enough start. And for me, you know, developing that, you know, higher power, as I don't necessarily understand him, you know, it's been a process. It's been a process. You know, I gave an honest effort to go back to that church I grew up in. And although I liked the church, I didn't care much for the people. I guess I'm spoiled by the AA fellowship. Because, you know, those regular earthlings out there, I don't necessarily always get along with them well.
I feel like, yeah, there's the church that I go to is a very accepting of people, you know, that have these kinds of problems with addicts and stuff like that. And they openly talk about it. And I think that that can really make all the difference. I mean, when your pastor stands up there and talks about, you know, like literally wanting to help people that have struggles with addiction or pornography or anything destructive, gambling, you know, cheating on their spouse, and that you can come talk to them about these things and that they're not going to be like looking down at you and stuff. I feel like that makes all the difference. And my church really does talk about that. And then they'll come alongside of you and be like, what can we do? What can we do together and bring community? And so, yeah. And a church that wouldn't, I feel like that would be hard in the beginning. Absolutely.
Oh yeah.
Because absolutely. The last thing in the world you need when dealing with alcoholism or drug addiction is to go into somewhere where the people actually are going to look down at you or make you feel shameful.
That's the thing that I really love about Alcoholics Anonymous, mm-hmm. and the Fellowship of AA is that, you know, no matter what else you may have experienced in your life with religious communities, we don't shoot our wounded, period. Right. If you go out and make a mistake and you're out there drinking again or you're doing bad stuff and you come back into an AA meeting, nobody's going to be saying, I told you so, or you shouldn't have done that. They're going to be saying, we're glad you're back. That's all they're going to be saying.
Yeah.
Welcome home. We're glad you're back. You know, we just don't do that. We just don't shoot our wounded. It's all about acceptance. There's nobody in there that feels like they're better than anybody else. If they do, they're not being honest.
Right. And they're not going to be around very long.
And they're not going to be around very long. Like right.
They might be
said,
back later, you know? But they might have to take another round.
But this idea that I somehow have to earn God's favor is really a problem. And one of the things that differentiates us, I think, from a lot of religious organizations. And it was a very hard thing for me to do, to realize that God's intention towards me, Jonathan, was good, just like a father might have towards his child. You know, if his child goes out and steals candy from the store, or if he rides his bike out in the street and falls down and breaks his leg, the dad's not going to come up and say, I told you shouldn't have done that. You know, you're a bad boy. That's not what a father does. He picks the child up and comforts it and takes care of it. That's kind of how my higher power is with me. You know, if I decide to go off and do my own thing, he's not going to stop me. He's going to let me do my own thing if I want to. When the shit hits the fan, excuse me if I can't say that on the radio, when the fertilizer hits the radio, the
there you go.
Ventilator, you know, and I'm crying out for help, he'll be there, you know. But it's better off for me if I try to figure out how to live within that direction and that guidance, because it's there simply for the asking. And this program really teaches us how to do that, and it's pretty much about relationships. Your relationship with your higher power, like I said, is your relationship with your higher power. It's not my place to tell you what that is or anybody else's. And our problem at the heart of this disease is that, like I said, we felt alone and by ourselves and different from other people. And, at the heart of this thing is our inability to form a true partnership relationship with another human being. We just don't know how to do that. And if you look at the steps, especially steps 4 through 9, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. You know, how have I hurt other people? What have I done bad? What are my sins against my brothers and sisters? Admit it to God and to another human being and to myself, you know, the exact nature of our wrongs, step 5. 6, became willing to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all people we'd harmed and made direct amends to, became willing to make direct amends to them. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would harm them. What's that all about? What's happening in that process? I am repairing and restoring damaged relationships. That's what this is all about. And teaching myself and learning from others and learning from God how to have relationships with other people in a positive and fruitful way. And if I can find the way through that and how to do that with people in my life, I'm going to feel really good about who Jonathan is. I'm not going to have that toxic shame and that toxic guilt that makes me want to go out and drink and use again. It's not there. I'm cleaning up my side of the street. I'm cleaning up my house. There's not going to be any dark spaces left inside my mind or my heart. I'm putting it out there in the open where it can't control me anymore or poison me anymore. And that's really the process that we go through here. And, the result of that, we end up at this step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. It's a psychic change. It's a renewing of the mind. It is an awakening, and it creates a life and a lifestyle that's unbelievably fulfilling and enjoyable. Something that we could not have as addicts and alcoholics without this. Now, I will say this: I haven't met anybody that I didn't think couldn't use a 12-step program.
I agree.
But for addicts and alcoholics, it's utterly necessary. We need this to survive. We are not like, the people out in the world are like fish swimming around in the sea, and we're swimming around with them, but we're not fish. We're whales. We have to come up to breathe. And where I come up to breathe is an AA meeting.
There you go.
With the other whales, I have to have that. If I can, because they understand my insanity of this disease. And by being able to relate to other alcoholics and addicts, it makes it okay for me to go out there in the world and to live life sober and to live life in recovery and to have those relationships. And I continue to do that. I practice these principles in all my affairs like we're asked to do. And it works. It's an awesome way of life.
That's awesome. Well, listen, we are up against the clock here. I want to say thank you to you, Jonathan, for coming in, sharing your story and your thoughts.
Absolutely.
With us.
Absolutely, thank you.
My pleasure, anytime.
And Denise, thank you for
thank being, you, Johnny.
My co-host today. And
my pleasure.
It looks like we may have pulled off another one. So
yeah, we're going to go out and enjoy the nice weather, too.
That's right. And
yeah.
Go do that. And yes, and we're out of here.
Stay in the light.